Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's Retail Focus Podcast. So much to talk about as so many companies released earnings reports for their last fiscal quarter over the past week. Lots of retail companies in the news, and we'll talk about many of them, including Home Depot, Restoration Hardware, Nordstrom, and more coming up. But we begin with the company that perhaps grabbed most of the headlines late in the week as JCPenney finally released their fourth quarter fiscal year 2016 earnings on Friday. Their earnings report was a mixed bag, but what everyone picked up on was another press release they sent out announcing potential closures of between 130 and 140 stores, as well as a couple of distribution centers. And as you can imagine, if you've been following the retail landscape over the past couple of years, what resulted was a media frenzy talking about the potential death of malls in the future and how JCPenney is seeing the same pressures as Macy's and Sears. But the reality of it is, based on this earnings report, there are a few more reasons to be optimistic surrounding JCPenney's future than those other two businesses.
Absolutely. And it's reflective within their guidance is the overall same store sales came in as expected for the company. Same store sales did fall 0.7%, but ended up flat for the full fiscal year. So keep in mind, this is for the fourth quarter fiscal year 2016. So we also have some full year results as well. Net sales for the quarter were even with last year's same quarter results coming in around $4 billion. However, they delivered better numbers on the margin front. You did see gross margin did decline a little bit by about 100 basis points to 33.1% of sales. However, this was more than offset by selling, general, and administrative expenses, which were down $37 million to 23.4%. And this is a 70 basis point improvement overall versus last year. So this is kind of a theme Marvin Ellison has been talking about for some time, is really honing in on what they need to cut back on. And I think this is representative in this figure. You see $37 million down in selling, general, and administrative expenses, while they really didn't close many stores last year. So it's not attributable to store closures and the fact that they only had seven stores closed last year, mostly in smaller markets. So they've really been doing a good job through the supply chain and the marketing expense arena. I think this is a good sign for JCPenney in 2017. This all led to an improvement overall on the net income front as they reported a net income. In the previous quarters, they've actually been reporting larger and larger losses. However, a net income for the fourth quarter came in at $192 million or 61 cents per share, up by $323 million. You can see through that larger figure that they had a loss during the same period last year. Adjusted earnings per share came in at 64 cents per share. This was over last year's mark of 39 cents per share. They actually had a net loss last year, but on an adjusted basis, they recorded a profit. The full fiscal 2016 results, net sales slightly down, $12.6 billion last year. Now they're $12.5 billion. But again, a very slight margin there. And this is possibly attributable to them having a lot of restructuring within their individual locations. We spoke of an appliance rollout within about 500 of their 1,014 locations. So I think this really speaks to how they've been able to adjust despite having a lot of changes inside their store and then structurally as well. We talk about management changes, a lot of strategy changing over the last 4 to 5 quarters. And again, they are profitable, and this is attributable to the fourth quarter. Net income for the full fiscal year came in at just $1 million. But again, on an earnings per share basis, it was negative $1.68 per share. Fiscal 2015 actually had a net loss of $513 million. And then I did a little digging. Back in 2013, the company as a whole for the year had a net loss of $1.3 billion. So again, Sears and JCPenney were actually in the same conversation as companies that were going to be going bankrupt in a short amount of time back in this period. And now you see that this company has truly rebounded from these talks with a net income this quarter.
I think it's short-sighted to put JCPenney in the same category as a retailer like Sears Holdings, which is, as you mentioned, in imminent danger of going bankrupt. Marvin Ellison has done a great job in turning JCPenney around, and there are actually a lot of positive signs. And in fact, when you look at some of their things that they've been mentioning over the last year and some of the things that our listeners are probably tired of us mentioning, including the Sephora store-in-store rollout that's been wondrously received, and the appliance rollout, which they said that they had seen success from about Thanksgiving on. And we'll get a better idea as to how the appliance rollout impacts their top line revenue this coming fiscal year. As Leighton mentioned, they ripped up about 500 of their stores and put appliances in some of the square footage so as to use the square footage within the stores better. And that's something they mentioned in the third quarter release, is the fact that that might have trimmed sales off towards the end of the year because they were in the midst of redoing a lot of their real estate and redoing a lot of their square footage inside stores. So it curtailed customers' access to certain areas of the store, made things a little bit more difficult for the store traffic that they did have. One of the more interesting things about this entire earnings release was their holding in e-commerce and also their notes about inventory. We'll start with inventory. Their inventory actually rose, and in some circumstances, as we'll talk about a little later on, for a retailer, this may not be a good thing. This tells you that you've got money tied up in either stale or stagnant inventory. However, for JCPenney, they have to have inventory rising in order to keep up with some of their newer store trends. And much of the increase, they went out of their way to mention, was tied into floor samples for appliance sales. So they needed floor samples and floor models, display models for their large appliance showrooms, and also making sure that their Sephora store-in-store concepts had appropriate amounts of inventory. So that's where a lot of the inventory increase went. It's not so much clothes sitting on the shelves for an extended period of time, but rather it sits in appliances and their Sephora concept, which makes sense as they built those out to a large extent. And as far as e-commerce is concerned, and as far as some of their omni-channel offerings is concerned, they did see double-digit online sales increases for the year. So even though in-store traffic was down just slightly, they did see online sales increases. And as they've mentioned in the past, Marvin Ellison was quick to mention in this earnings call that still 75% of their orders touch a store in some way. Part of this is due to the catalog system that JCPenney has had set up for years. So they kind of had omni-channel built into their stores a little bit earlier than many other large retailers did. And so customers are still used to going into JCPenney and picking up their orders. The nice thing for the retailer is that they didn't have to necessarily include some of these aspects in their stores, as they already had catalog spaces out there. They were also able to, because of sending orders to stores, reduce some of their impairment costs on shipping, as many retailers begin to offer free or reduced shipping. If they can get more people to go to the stores, go that last mile and pick up in store, it's going to reduce not only the customer's burden on shipping, but also JCPenney's burden to get that product shipped from their warehouse as compared to just sending it with the normal freight that's going to the store anyway. However, you'll notice that we haven't yet talked about the item that really controlled most of the news cycle as far as JCPenney is concerned over the last portion of the week, and it's this plan to close 130 to 140 stores. Now, JCPenney in their news release spun it as, and I quote, a plan to optimize retail operations, advance growth, and drive profitability. Of course, that's a very shareholder-centric term. A lot of other news outlets picked up on this and said basically that instead this is a plan that they're employing because brick and mortar is shrinking back and mall space is dying. However, when you look at these locations and look a little bit closer at the numbers, I think you can jump to a conclusion that states that many of these locations, in fact, aren't at malls at all. And part of the reason that they're closing these locations is that these locations cannot be upgraded or cannot be scaled upwards to meet the standards of now what JCPenney considers their new floor format with both the appliances and the Sephora rollout. So these are smaller stores, or many of these are smaller square footage stores. They've been lagging behind in sales. In fact, even though the 130 to 140 stores account for about 13 to 14% of their store locations, they currently have 1,014 locations. This closure is said to affect only 5% of their total annual top-line revenue. So these stores are lagging vastly behind in terms of top-line sales. Yet still, as we talk about with retailers, these stores are paying rents. They're obviously paying employees, and they're paying all the utilities to keep these stores open. So these are a bit of a burden on the system. And although it does cut down on some of the omni-channel services they're able to offer customers in the markets that'll be seeing these stores close, I think from a bottom line standpoint, it's almost necessary for them to right size their store base. And we've known this has been coming now for a good 12 months.
Yeah, and I think this really comes as the company is trying to boost their brand image and they're trying to restructure financially. So you alluded to some very good points there. Marvin Ellison actually had a meeting with a real estate conference back in the first week of January, and he mentioned a few very good points that really carry over to this press release that they just announced this last Thursday. But he said that there were only about a dozen stores that were unprofitable in their portfolio of over 1,000 stores. But he said that they've really been looking at the stores in the smaller markets. Those smaller markets are ones that are going to have a little bit less top line revenue per location. And then also he said that the mall locations, which they intend to close throughout 2017, are ones that the mall really hasn't been taking care of their tenants. So perhaps these malls are a little dilapidated. The malls overall may be seeing lesser traffic trends. So they're really careful in looking at each individual location and not just looking at maybe the city or the region of the country before making these decisions. He said upon this announcement that they looked very closely at the stores they were going to be closing. And this is coming down to putting investment towards the stores that are going to be existing after this sell-off. So I think this is going to be good for the company in that they can really unlock the capital. And you mentioned a very good point in that this only represents 5% of the total annual top line revenue, but again, it's 13 to 14% of locations. So really dragging down their margins, really dampening their company performance overall. Lastly, with the plan here from JCPenney, voluntary layoffs they announced with this, 6,000 salaried employees will be offered early retirement packages, and this is to trim some fat. But this is typically a good route if you're trying to lay off employees. You're giving employees the option if they want to leave the company and giving them very good packages in order to leave the company. And I think that most of the ones that are going to be taking these offers are ones that have been with the company for a while, and so maybe their productivity is not in line with company expectations, and maybe they're really not aligned with the company's strategy. So I think this is going to be good for the company. And of course, not all 6,000 offers are going to be taken, but we can see that a very good portion of these probably will be. And in total, with the store closures and the layoffs, the company said they'll be saving over $200 million annually. And that's a lot of money for a company that is now having a resurgence.
This is another area where there's a little bit of a disconnect between some of the headlines and what's actually happening. Is the headline said that JCPenney would lay off almost 6,000 employees, and that's not really the case. In fact, they're just offering early retirement to these 6,000 employees. As Leighton mentioned, not all will bite, but the neat thing for them is they get to then use some of these openings not only to make sure that their expenses are in line with industry norms, but also to use these open positions to backfill with employees that are coming from some of these stores that will close down. As most retailers, even Sears Holdings, which has been in very bad shape, has offered these employees jobs at other locations when and where they can. So that is something that's in the works for JCPenney. One other thing to note about some of the store closures that they see in the next few months is that a lot of these stores are likely to be what they call in their system the second tier and third tier stores. And these stores haven't had the same product mix as their first tier stores for the last several years. In fact, these are stores that are usually in smaller to mid-sized markets. Many of them are freestanding. They're not actually in malls. Many of them are freestanding happening in maybe your typical small to mid-sized market, real estate holdings, strip malls, that type of thing. Additionally, many of these are not getting the first run of product mix. So another thing that this allows JCPenney to do is become a little bit more standardized in terms of their product mix in stores. So when you visit one JCPenney, it should be consistent with another, but it also enables consistency across management of merchandising, including corporate planograms. In many of these other locations, in many of these small market locations, you've got one floor JCPenney stores that have significantly less square footage than the larger market stores in larger places. So this will help the company just as far as standardization of what they're able to offer the customer. And that way, when customers go into a small market store or go into any JCPenney store that remains, their experience will be much similar across the board. Finally, we get to their fiscal year 2017 outlook, which they addressed at the very end of their earnings call. They're looking for comparable store sales in fiscal year 2017 to be essentially flat, negative 1% to 1% same store sales. Although, as we've talked about before, since their appliance rollout only hit last fall, if they do see a bump from that, it would be in the first three quarters of fiscal year 2017. They also carry with themselves more gross margin hopes, as well as hopes for more decreases on the selling, general, and administrative expenses front. They look for full year adjusted earnings per share of 40 cents to 65 cents at their current share price after this latest earnings release. And we should mention that their shares went down somewhat. They went down from about 690 the day before the release to about 650 after the release, dipping down as far as $6.10. But at their current share price with this earnings per share, this would give them a price to earnings ratio of around 10 to 15, meaning that the market doesn't necessarily see the same growth that JCPenney sees as far as bottom line revenue is concerned, but there is a potential that they could provide some value going forward. This is completely amazing. And I think when we look back at the last 7 years or so of JCPenney, if you had told me that they would be profitable and may have earnings per share by 2017 of 65 cents per share, it's pretty remarkable considering, as Leighton mentioned, some of the losses that they were showing, over $1 billion in losses during some fiscal year. And we should keep in mind that this is their first full year show of profitability, 2016 was at least, since 2010. So overall, it seems like the company is headed in the right direction, although some employees and some markets that may be losing a JCPenney will certainly take a hit from their store closure plan.
Well, with that, we move on to Home Depot. They reported their fourth quarter earnings, and they exceeded expectations in a number of ways, causing shares of the retailer to pop in after-hours trading. For the year, the company hit a record $94.6 billion, up $6.1 billion from fiscal 2015. Record revenue and profit for the full year. Earnings per share were up 18.1% to $6.45 per share. Revenue for the quarter, the fourth quarter for Home Depot, $22.21 billion versus the $21.8 from the consensus estimate from Thomson Reuters. This represents an 8.8% increase overall year over year. Comparable sales, the same store sales metric that we often talk about, a 5.8% increase overall for the company versus the 3.7% increase that analysts had projected. This is the interesting part. U.S. stores were up 6.3%. So typically with a mature retailer, you'll see comps in international units that are going to be a little higher than U.S. stores. This is not the case with Home Depot. You see a really strong housing market and a lot of other factors we'll talk about later really contributing to this number of 6.3%. All regions had positive comps. There's about a dozen different regions Home Depot breaks their business out into in the United States. All reported positive same-store sales. Earnings per share were up 23.1% to $1.44 per share. Average ticket grew and transactions grew. Ticket grew by 2.9% and transaction growth was 2.8%. So very strong numbers. And what's interesting here is that the company said that traffic actually surprised their previous guidance. Operating expenses improved by 113 basis points as well, and it came to 20.8% of sales. They continue to see this trend in 2017 as well, saying that for every 1% increase in sales growth, they see a 0.49% increase in operating expenses. This is in line with projections that they had back in 2015. So the company is really executing at a very high level here, being very accurate with their predictions. The one downside here is the gross margins decreased ever so slightly by 10 basis points to 34% in the fourth quarter. They cited increased supply chain expenses, and this is likely due to some online initiatives that they've had over the last few quarters. Their online strategy has evolved with time. They've paid more attention to the consumer, really meeting them where they are. Double-digit online sales growth, 19%. In the fourth quarter. Typically with some retailers, you'll see 10, 11%. We know that Best Buy had around 11% pop in their online sales growth. Management said 45% of online orders are picked up in stores. And this relates to what we were just talking about with JCPenney and that they had 75% of orders touch a store. And I think this really ties into how they're utilizing their omni-channel capabilities, getting those customers inside the store, potentially getting some other purchases outside of the ones they're just making online once they get to the individual location. New store order management system also was fully implemented. The acronym is BODFS, and it's a buy online, deliver from store. And they said this really cuts down on the last mile shipping expense, which is, again, something we had alluded to in the JCPenney story. But Trent, this is a larger theme here, a theme of a business that keeps on getting stronger and stronger throughout every sequential quarter. And this is something that a lot of analysts have been saying, well, this is a mature company from the brick and mortar standpoint, but what did the company see as strengths that will carry them through 2017?
Well, one of the things that Home Depot has noticed is the fact that the U.S. housing market has seen some strengths that will carry Home Depot through 2017. Home Depot is a business that is fairly reliant on new and renovated builds in the U.S. as far as the U.S. housing market is concerned. And it's interesting because Home Depot can benefit from a robust housing market, but they can also benefit from a fairly weak housing market from a home purchasing standpoint. Sometimes, and we look back to the Great Recession, as it's called, about 8 years ago, if the housing market slumps or if people aren't in a position to buy a new house, usually they are funneling money, albeit a little bit of money, into renovating their current homes or trying to find inexpensive homes to purchase and fix those up. But now with a robust housing market, what you're seeing is that people are being forced now to purchase some homes that need improvement right out of the gate. And so this will also help Home Depot going forward. They didn't mention commercial builds here in this particular release, but residential housing is predicted to represent 3.8% of gross domestic product in 2017. The historical average, we should keep in mind, is 4.7%, but still 3.8% relatively strong as far as Home Depot is concerned. And you mentioned the buy online, pick up in stores option, the fact that 45% of their online orders touch stores. Some of our listeners might wonder why it's not as great as JCPenney is, especially considering the number of contractors that place large online orders and then go to pick up from their contractor pickup stations at Home Depot. However, we should keep in mind that many of their larger appliance offerings right now cannot be picked up directly at the store. They can be delivered directly to a residence or business, but cannot be delivered to a store and then picked up from there. However, this is something that they are looking to adjust with that new customer order management system that Leighton mentioned. Looking at their last earnings numbers from the latest quarter, all of their categories had positive comps. And we saw more positive comps in flooring and tools than we did in lighting, which came in last in terms of their positive comps. And also their indoor garden was somewhat lagging behind. Oftentimes going forward for Home Depot, when you're looking at these individual categories, spring is a tough season to compare categories. This is comparing, of course, from fall and winter. But once you get into the spring, you start talking a little more lawn and garden. People are getting out of their houses a little bit more, investing in exterior home renovation and that type of thing. And if we get kind of a weird spring weather-wise throughout the United States, and so far, at least through most of the United States, it's been a warmer than normal pre-spring. If you get a warmer than normal spring, you might see a little bit of a sales bump as well in the first quarter of this next fiscal year. Strongest categories, though, for Home Depot, likely tied to most new home sales or remodels. And when we see how their transactions are coming in, we note that transactions of $900 or more, so major transactions, likely major appliances, things like washers and dryers, but also massive investments into housing, now represent about 20% of U.S. sales. And we should mention that not all of their sales are direct to the public. They are to contractors through their pro systems, which they are attempting to bulk up for this next fiscal year. This representing 20% of U.S. sales puts it up 11.6 quarter over last year's quarter. So they are seeing more major transactions, and that is a huge driving point of their comparable store sales. But as Leighton mentioned, not only did the average ticket grow, which this number reflects, but transactions grew as well. And the fact that foot traffic increased surprised the business a little bit, caught them off guard. When we look at same-store sales numbers, the ideal mix of drivers of same-store sales growth, you want to be both ticket price and the amount of traffic in a store. And with Home Depot, it's split about 50-50. That's usually a sign of a healthy retailer going forward. If this gain had been bolstered simply by transaction size, that would give you a little bit of a cause for pause regarding the future of Home Depot. But the fact that their traffic is up and their average ticket is also up suggests potentially some strong quarters ahead. They do have some promotions, though, Leighton, that are coming up, and this may make or break their first two quarters of 2017.
Yeah, and as with the last few years, they're having a spring Black Friday sale, which they were quick to mention during the press release here with the earnings release. But it's not only advertising and promotion that they're going to be putting a lot more capital expense into. They have a 2017 capital spending plan of around $2 billion, and this is going to help remodel stores, help revitalize some older locations, and then also help with continuous improvement with their omnichannel initiatives that we spoke about earlier. Really helping to refresh these stores is going to help their brand image, of course, but then also you have to see this company as one that has a lot of stores in their portfolio, and they're not really building out many stores. They mentioned that in 2017, they plan to only open a few stores, just six in 2017 in total. Currently, as of this report, they had 2,278 stores in all 50 states. And so when we're talking about a home improvement retailer that has deep market penetration, I think this is one of them. I think this is one of the reasons why the stock price was fairly stagnant. It did pop to an all-time high of $1.45 a share, but you saw that it only raised about 2.5% after the earnings release. And I think that's because the company is mature for one, and two, the company already had some lofty expectations built in because they've been performing so well and so profitably quarter after quarter. They said they will project positive cash flows, record cash flows for 2017. $11.3 billion is what they're projecting. And I think this company is operating at an extremely high level, and they'll continue to do so. What's curious to me is how Lowe's is going to perform on their next earnings report, because Home Depot is kind of the bellwether for the industry in that they have about a twice as large They have about double the market cap of a Lowe's. And so anytime Lowe's is about to report, everyone looks to the performance of Home Depot. And I think that's very important going forward.
We'll keep our eye on Lowe's, but also a company like True Value, which is a co-op company. Right now, their sales through the first three quarters of fiscal year 2017 were up 1.5%. We'll see if the fourth quarter is as robust for them as it is for Home Depot. We've moved back to fashion as Nordstrom joined the earnings release fray. So many earnings releases over this past week, and not only did they release their fourth quarter fiscal year 2016 earnings, but also released full year results as well as what they see as far as guidance for fiscal year 2017. But their earnings did draw mixed reviews. Some were incredibly positive from analysts, noting that they outpaced many of their mall brethren, and in fact, their stock did pop about 5% after the earnings call in trading on Friday, February 24th. Meanwhile, other analysts chose to focus on falling sales at their flagship brand and falling mall traffic levels, as well as falling traffic levels at their flagship brand. And this is something that we saw a few months ago when Goldman Sachs downgraded them because of the lack of what they called a magic bullet to drive store traffic. But Nordstrom is so much more than just store traffic to their flagship brand. They have a number of different brands, and fortunately for us, they split a lot of their earnings release into results brand by brand. Leighton, why don't you address some of the numbers here?
Comparable store sales decreased 2.7% for the Nordstrom brand, the namesake stores, the full-line stores, Nordstrom.com, and Trunk Club. Trunk Club is included in that metric. Top line decreased 1.1%. As I alluded to, off-price once again led the way with 4.3% positive comp sales and a top-line increase of 10.7%. This included the Rack concept, NordstromRack.com, and Hot Look. Overall, top-line was $14.498 billion versus the $14.095 they had during fiscal year 2015. So this represented a 2.8% increase overall. So a lot of analysts that had previously said that this company is stagnant, well, they're still showing top-line revenue. However, mostly through the Rack concept, and I think that's where they're going to be providing a lot of the growth for the future. They were lauded by some analysts for their cost control measures, however, including a 60 basis point drop in selling, general, and administrative expenses and inventory declines of about 2.5%. The company said they've been able to manage inventory a lot better. They had a lot of tools that were initiated for the quarter, and I think that's really helped bring their inventory numbers down. They exist in a spot right now where the inventory decline can be seen as a positive, and really the scarcity or perceived scarcity isn't a bad thing. They pointed out that inventory control measures in their presentation were very strong during the last three quarters, provide some strengths, whereas before, if you were to look at their performance with inventory in years prior, it wasn't up to par. Earnings per share came in for the company at $1.15 per share, excluding the Trunk Club impairment, of $1.37 per share. So you can see that they took a massive loss on Trunk Club for the year, though, however, $2.02 per share. This sets their price-to-earnings ratio at a growth-centric one at 24. Again, I think that growth is primarily due to the Rack concept and their initiatives going forward.
Well, let's look at where the company sees themselves as being headed during the next fiscal year. And as Leighton mentioned, the fact that comparable store sales did decline for the Nordstrom brand does indicate falling traffic levels there. But what it also indicates is some stagnation on Nordstrom.com, which is lumped into those comps, and also with Trunk Club. We've talked before about Trunk Club's struggles over the past year or two since they were acquired by Nordstrom, and it doesn't seem as though they're really helping out top-line revenue or boosting the comparable store sales numbers. I'll talk about that here in just one moment. As far as growth for the next year with store count, they see one new Nordstrom store and two full-line store relocations. The store relocations will take place in California with the new Nordstrom store in Toronto, where they are seeing a lot of growth north of the border. They'll have six outlets in Canada by the end of 2017, where they had just three outlets in Canada at the end of 2015. But perhaps more importantly, they plan on expanding their Rack concept. They have 15 new Rack stores in the works, as well as one Rack store relocation. This will push them far closer to a 50-50 revenue split between their two brands, which again are the Nordstrom brand and the Rack set of brands, which not only includes Rack, but NordstromRack.com and Hot Look, as Leighton mentioned. Currently, the revenue split between their full-line stores and the Rack concept is 69-31, by which we mean that 69% of their top-line revenue comes from the Nordstrom brand, their full-price line, whereas 31% comes from the Rack stores. And this is actually ahead of schedule from where the company figured they would be at this point. At the end of 2015, they figured the mix might be 70-30 by 2020. So they've beaten that projection by several years. And in some cases, you might raise an eyebrow and say, well, perhaps that's not a good thing that their full-line stores aren't performing. But here, you're seeing solid same-store sales increases from Rack, and Nordstrom is going ahead and putting some eggs in that basket. They expanded Rack from 194 stores to 215 stores during fiscal year 2016, and they plan to expand to as many as 230 stores in the Rack concept by the end of fiscal year 2017. By comparison, they have 118 full-line stores and 5 Nordstrom Canada stores. That number will grow to 6 by the end of the next fiscal year, at least so the company says. Now, keep in mind, this split between their full-line brand and off-price was 82% to 18% as recently as 2010. So Nordstrom is growing where the market is also growing. We talk about all the success that off-price retailers have had, whether it's TJX, whether it's Ross or even other companies. We're seeing now growth in terms of store count from Burlington Coat Factory as well. And Nordstrom is basically meeting the consumer where they are at now. A potential danger, though, going forward could be their reliance on women's apparel to drive sales. This has been a notoriously soft category throughout brick and mortar retailers over the last 6 quarters or so. And even when you look at a retailer that's had such solid 2-year stack numbers as JCPenney in comparable store sales, they are seeing some softness in women's apparel, which makes up about 20% of the sales at Nordstrom company-wide. Shoe sales make up about 15%, and then men's apparel around 10%. One of the reasons, in fact, they purchased Trunk Club was they felt like it would give them an opportunity to strengthen their hold in men's apparel, as it is mostly a men's apparel system. Nordstrom continued to emphasize the growth in their rewards program. They now have 7.8 million rewards customers. That's something that we've talked about on previous podcasts. So not only do they see more customer engagement among their rewards members, but they also see increased foot traffic from those rewards members or increased trips to Nordstrom. And so the rewards membership program has been crucial to driving what growth they have had. And they found that Rack was again the largest source of their new members during the entirety of fiscal year 2016. Looking ahead, despite these traffic issues we've talked about in their full price stores, despite not having what Goldman Sachs called a magic bullet, which they wanted Nordstrom to have to grow in 2017 and beyond, they have noted some growth in e-commerce, particularly in their Rack division. No surprise there. They're seeing growth everywhere else in their Rack division. They saw 32% sales growth in e-commerce in their Rack division during fiscal year 2016 compared to fiscal year 2015. However, the sales growth was a little bit more stagnant with their Nordstrom e-commerce division. They didn't mention it in the earnings call, and I investigated as to why they didn't happen to mention it in their earnings call, as they did have $2.5 billion in sales in the e-commerce division of their full price line in 2016. But as you look back at the numbers from fiscal year 2015, the math gets a little funky, because 2016 was actually the first year that they folded Trunk Club into their Nordstrom e-commerce division from a numbers standpoint. So Trunk Club was left out of their e-commerce numbers from fiscal year 2015. They categorized them separately as other retail sales that year. So we don't know exactly how much those same websites in that e-commerce division of the full price line made in 2015. But it looks, eyeballing it, like it was pretty close to $2.5 billion, no less than $2.3 billion, which is what Nordstrom.com brought in. So assuming the number is at the low end of that, $2.3 billion, that's still less than a 10% increase. So that's probably why they didn't mention e-commerce growth in their full price division. But in all likelihood, it was a little bit lower of an increase. So I think on a macro level, there might be some argument that perhaps they're devaluing their brand with the strength of their off-price concept, with the strength of their Rack concept. But perhaps more to the point, Trunk Club has proved a burden on Nordstrom pretty much since they bought them. Their website is kind of all over the place. It tries to appeal to older generations, yet a lot of younger millennials are the ones more likely to engage in this program. So Trunk Club, basically all over the place for Nordstrom. And that is something that they'll have to figure out going forward if they want to bolster e-commerce sales for their full price brand.
Shares of Nordstrom, ticker JWN, were up 4.5% on Friday to $46 a share, but still down 20% if you look at the 3 months prior. They have a price-to-earnings ratio of around 23 and a market cap currently of $7.8 billion. And this, again, was after the stock popped on Friday. Well, we're back with Walmart, North America's largest retailer, as they released earnings for their fourth quarter fiscal year 2017. And it went fairly well for the retailer beyond company expectations. Total revenue grew 3% to $133.6 billion. This excludes foreign currency impacts. If you include the foreign currency impacts, you're looking at total top line revenue of around $130.9 billion for the quarter, or an increase of 1% overall. Diluted earnings per share for the company came in at $1.22 per share, which includes the impact of discrete items detailed in the overall press release. This actually came in at $1.30 if you exclude these items. So within company guidance, the company is performing fairly well. Operating cash flow for the company hit an all-time high of $31.5 billion. Same-store sales for the U.S. came in at 1.8%, beating company guidance. They cited strong traffic trends, according to Doug McMillon, their CEO. And honestly, this really ties in what we were saying with Home Depot. Surprising the company expectations is always a good thing, at least from a shareholder's perspective going forward. Overall, if you split this company into their different segments in the domestic market, you see that neighborhood market comp store sales increased 5.3%, which is very good considering all of the grocery industry pressure. We talk about the competitive nature of grocers. A lot of emerging retailers such as Sprouts, Natural Grocers, Whole Foods is still in there growing every year. So a lot of pressure there, but to see those comps within the grocery industry is a very positive thing. Doug McMillon said that a lot of their strengths came through their HR investment. So by this, he means the wage investment and the benefits investment they've been making over the past few quarters. Initially, shareholders were opposed to this, and you saw this as indicated in the stock prices. It fell from all-time highs upon these announcements, but you see that these raises and base hourly rates, as well as different mechanisms for providing raises and promotions, has really provided the company associates with a boost in morale. They also cited an increase in technology for associates. We're talking about new handheld inventory devices, and also an increased investment overall in technology, which has helped inventory levels come down 7% year over year. So again, Doug McMillon was very quick to point out that associate engagement really has been helping those location sales, those individual sales, at least in the United States. As for Sam's Club, same store sales were also better than expected. They came in at a positive 2.4%. And with that announcement, they announced that John Furner will take the CEO spot since the resignation of Rosalind Brewer. And this is a really good thing for the company, as John Furner has a deep knowledge of Sam's Club as a whole. John Furner has been with the company since 1993 and most recently was Sam's Club's chief marketing officer. Moving on to the e-commerce segment, it was stated that the Walmart app is now among the three top apps in the retail sector. For the quarter, they cited increased U.S. e-commerce sales, 36% increase in gross merchandise volume, increasing by 26%. So they are just killing it. And Trent, I think this really has a lot to do with the addition of Mark Lohr, the former Jet CEO and founder, coming aboard and really making some quick changes and new initiatives for the e-commerce division of the company.
And keep in mind, too, that the increase in U.S. e-commerce sales would not have included Jet.com last year, whereas it does include Jet.com this year. So they see an automatic pop just from traffic going to Jet.com, as well as some of their other e-commerce purchases like ShoeBuy, for example. But Mark Lohr does deserve some credit for this increase in e-commerce sales. And I don't want to play the long game necessarily, but I honestly don't think it'll be until the fourth quarter of the next fiscal year when we'll see any type of appreciable impact, where we'll see the true impact that Mark Lohr has been able to have on their e-commerce division and how much he can grow it out. The Walmart.com marketplace has improved their SKU count fourfold in the past 12 months. And again, part of this is because they've been able to integrate partnerships with other websites, like, for example, Jet.com. They now have 35 million different products. As of last June, Amazon and its marketplace and all of its sellers had over 380 million different products. So there is still a little bit of a difference there between Walmart.com and Amazon.com. Saying a little bit of a difference is kind of an intentional understatement. However, you have a lot of different products that coincide between these two. When you see the top Amazon products and the number of products that they have over 82 million products in cell phone accessories alone. And this extends to things like electronics, where they have 31 million products. And that's nearly as many different products as Walmart has as a whole. And then sports and outdoors, they have nearly 24 million products on Amazon.com. But Walmart has continued to build out their e-commerce presence. Again, acquisitions like ShoeBuy, Hayneedle, which we really haven't talked about on the podcast, and Moose Jaw, which we talked about last week on the podcast. All of those will give Walmart more SKUs to play with in an e-commerce space. The key is, though, how do they integrate those additional SKUs into their distribution platform so they can offer more omni-channel engagement with customers, more buy online, pick up in store options. I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk about the Sam's Club division, especially since Rosalind Brewer stepped down as CEO. John Furner is stepping up. You mentioned their comps. Their same store sales were better than expected at 2.4%. for this last quarter, but they released 2017 guidance, which would be their fiscal 2018, and they see same-store sales increases for Sam's Club in the 1% to 2% range. And in fact, they're advising guidance for Sam's Club, excluding fuel, of around 1% or perhaps a little bit higher than 1%. And this gives me cause for pause, because when we look over at their main competitor in Costco, and this is not to say that BJ's wholesale stores aren't a big competitor, but Costco has a little bit more market share than does BJ's. Costco releases their same-store sales on a month-by-month basis. And dating back to December, Costco has seen mid-single-digit comps. Back in December alone, for the 5 weeks in December, they showed 3% same-store sales increases. And then for January, they showed 6% same-store sales increases in the U.S. and 11% comp store increases in Canada. So this kind of raises an issue and a little bit of a red flag for me. I know Walmart, when we talk about the company as a whole, we talk about their comparable store sales, we know that they're going to be pretty normalized. Walmart is so big that you're going to see sales from 0% to 2%. They came in on the higher end of that this last year, and that was a positive sign for the retailer. But again, because they are so big, you're not going to see a lot of variance one way or another. But Sam's Club doesn't have the same issue, even though Sam's Club does own a lot of market share in the wholesale and warehouse space. They tend to see a little bit more variance in same store sales. And that's why I think this number is worrisome. They see same store sales for the fiscal first quarter, which ends April 28th, being around 1%. And meanwhile, Costco, during this same period of time, is seeing same store sales in excess of 5%. Leighton, I know you are intimately familiar with the warehouse space, not only with Sam's Club, but also with Costco and that type of thing. What might be holding Sam's Club back and allowing Costco to grab some of this market share?
You know, to be honest with you, I actually had seen those comps as well, and it surprised me a little bit. And I think they're just being consistent with previous guidance that they had rolled out. So we talked about them beating guidance for same store sales this quarter. And I think that has to do with a number of factors. You're seeing that Club Pickup integration has really picked up for them. Also, their e-commerce division has done very well. They've made some enhancements to their mobile platform. But then also their online in-store shopping tools have really helped boost sales and customer convenience. You're talking about a tool that allows customers to pick off and scan each individual item and put it into their cart, and they're able to go and then check out with those items instead of having a cashier do it for them. So I think those tools and those mechanisms that they've been rolling out slowly but surely at the club level have really helped to boost those sales. And I think it took them by surprise. But Rosalind Brewer, everyone was saying that this was potentially not her decision to leave the company, but it appears so because she really did put forth a lot of this effort into integrating these new omnichannel platforms into the stores. But then also from the marketing aspect of it, she's been able to really explain how they're going into this new realm, and they've done so and executed at a very high level. So I think I would not be surprised to see higher than usual comps, higher than 1% at least than what they're guiding at. And as for Costco, I think a lot of analysts right now are saying that it's going to be hard for them to keep those mid-single digits throughout 2017 because of these competitive advantages that Sam's Club is putting through. And I think that this is one of the differentiators because you see Sam's Club, they have a wider base of shopping hours, and then now they have all of these e-commerce capabilities. They now have the most amount of SKUs on their website that they've had in prior years. And so I think Costco now has the pressure put on them, especially seeing that Sam's Club just beat their own personal comp. So a lot to look forward to in that aspect. For the company, we talk about guidance for Sam's Club, but 2017 guidance for Walmart as a whole, or fiscal 2018, earnings per share is projected to be between $4.20 per share and $4.40 per share. This is neutral when you're looking at full year results. This year, you're seeing earnings per share come in at $4.32 per share. Top line sales growth for the company overall, so all the divisions and international sections, 2 to 3% increase. And this includes currency fluctuations. Without currency fluctuations, you're seeing a rise between 3 and 4%. So the currency hurts the company, or at least that's what they're projecting going forward, depending on the currency fluctuations. But again, the focus overall has been on e-commerce. We talk about e-commerce with Sam's Club, but also Walmart.com, obviously. Trent, you talk about the extension in SKUs. This has been the focus, and it will be, and they said this throughout several times in the earnings call, that e-commerce is the future. And so they said that they are going to have $11 billion in capital expenditure to put towards the online infrastructure, and then also some potential acquisitions. They said the potential acquisitions actually were not included in the $11 billion capital expenditure plan, but a lot of moving parts for this company, a lot of areas that they see opportunity. And they had alluded to those acquisitions with Moose Jaw, Shoe Buy, and Hay Needle, saying that really it's more of the immediate capabilities rather than the merchandise. But they did cite some upscale merchandise opportunity there, and I think that has to do with the Moose Jaw acquisition as of late.
Speaking of upscale merchandise, on Thursday, Restoration Hardware, the ultra-premium furniture company, released preliminary fourth quarter results. They announced a $300 million share repurchase program. This is one of the things that sent shares soaring higher. Now, on the stock market, things looking mighty fine for Restoration Hardware as their shares took a bump of over 25%. In fact, they were up 24% after they released earnings, but still a little bit of halted growth, especially since they're going up against just horrendous comps from last year. And I mean horrendous in a bad way, as they were being dogged by inventory management issues and supply chain issues last year, showcasing delays of up to 6 months on certain products for their customers. So again, same store sales decreases that were sometimes in the double digits last year, we would expect Restoration Hardware to see a slight uptick this year. Adjusted net revenue is expected to reach $590 million for the fourth quarter, compared to the previous guidance of $562 million to $592 million. Again, these are preliminary fourth quarter results, so we don't have final numbers quite yet, but they feel like their earnings results will come in on the higher end of these numbers. Analysts' expectations were around $584 million, so positivity for Restoration Hardware. However, top-line revenue still would show a decline from last year, even with those same-store sales issues from a year ago. Restoration Hardware would be seeing a significant chunk taken out of their top line revenue because it came in at $647 million in the same quarter last year. You're seeing a decrease of $50 million, nearly a double-digit percentage decrease in overall top line revenue. You see the same thing, in fact, in their GAAP net income. They expect $8.74 million. This is compared to $33.3 million in the fourth quarter in fiscal 2015. So even though there's a lot of positivity about Restoration Hardware right now on the market, there were positive news reports coming out from analyst firms about Restoration Hardware. A lot of these numbers are kind of scary looking.
Absolutely. And this is for a number of reasons, but they had several initiatives in 2016 that brought on a lot of criticism from analysts. They had cited the new membership program as being a rough patch, and they said it was a financially tough year. But if you look back into those quarters, you're saying that most of those quarters were still fairly profitable, but less than half as profitable as they were in 2015. So I think this was a problem for the company, but it looks as though they have rebounded at least sequentially. So if we're looking towards the third quarter, we're seeing that gross margin was increasing, and we're also seeing that operating margin too now is increasing. However, if you're looking at operating margin in particular for the fourth quarter, it's slated to be 4.6%. Again, this is the unaudited figure, but we see the improvement sequentially. We see the third quarter brought in a margin of 2.8%, but the same quarter last year, the margin was 10.4%. So this is a massive margin for the company. I think this is why a lot of people were bullish on the company, because even though these are niche products that this retailer is selling, they are more upscale, as you had talked about. They carry a higher price point, and therefore they end up carrying a higher margin. But these improvements, these membership programs, these other things that they were doing, the investment into their e-commerce division really hurt their margins. And you saw this through these numbers. You see that gross margin ended up falling to around 30% when at one time it was around 40%. So gross margin for the fourth quarter is coming in at 33.5%, which again is sequentially better than the 32% they posted in the third quarter. But as I had talked about the membership model, just a little bit of a recap on that is it's a $100 membership, and it's 25% off full priced items and occasionally 20% off on sales. They also let you know about upcoming clearances before they do the regular customer. And they also have a free design service that you can use to help style your home and to take advantage of the new and unique offerings that they have on their website. And they also rebranded. They spent a lot of money on advertising when they rebranded to the RH Modern concept. And they've spent a lot in inventory reduction measures. So not only are they trying to have some inventory control mechanisms put in place, but the technology behind that has cost them a lot of money. And a simplified SKU count. They talked about an overall reduction in SKUs, and their website is simpler as a result of it. If you go on their website right now, they do have a lot less product offerings, but it's a little more simple as you go through and browse their different categories and different tabs on their website. Shares of the retailer, you said, were up 24%. However, they're still down 25% for the year. So this is a company that has still seen a lot of problems, but because of that share price, because of that relatively low share price, they were seeing highs of around $100 a share about a year and a half ago. The company now sees value in their own shares and believes it's a great time to get in on their undervalued stock. CEO Gary Friedman said that their balance sheet supports the idea that they have enough cash to repurchase shares in the short to midterm. They did not give a time frame for that $300 million share buyback program, but they're estimating that they have a few periods to buy back shares at their own discretion. $281 million is the amount of cash and cash equivalents at the end of fiscal 2016 that they have on the balance sheet. So certainly not a horrible cash position for the company. And despite all the bad press in the previous quarters, again, they are still a profitable company and one that has gained positive momentum as far as their brand awareness is concerned.
It's interesting that they mentioned inventory reduction in this press release, because I think you and I were both on the same page in thinking that that's something that they actually didn't need going into it. And we've talked about how certain companies have used inventory in their earnings releases to frame the company in one way or another. But when your company has had massive supply chain issues, massive issues in keeping things in stock, especially stemming back from last year, you worry a little little bit about that inventory reduction or inventory reduction plans in their strategic change. Yet, we're not going to see that yet in the fourth quarter because they see inventory levels of $754 million for fourth quarter of fiscal year 2016. That number was $725 million in the fourth quarter of fiscal year 2015. And keep in mind, that's where we started to see the supply chain issues pop up for Restoration Hardware. So they've only slightly increased, yet they want to decrease them back to 2016 numbers, all at the same time while opening six new design galleries in 2015. Now, I do like what they're doing with the design galleries. They're integrating things like cafes and wine vaults into their new design galleries, giving it a more upscale feel. But there is an overall concern about their membership program, called at one point in time the Gray Card, but now just the RH membership program, that you see gives you, again, 25% off every purchase at Restoration Hardware for a $100 cost up front. Now, the $100 cost up front has given the company some cash on hand, and in fact, they're actually able to turn that cash around to repurchasing a number of their shares, adding in and building in some value for the shareholders, which is one of the main reasons why the shares popped. Still, that was right around 30% of the company before the stock popped. So an interesting system here for Restoration Hardware. And still, you have to worry going forward that these supply chain issues may crop up again. We haven't seen any signs necessarily that they've been able to overcome this. And now they've got to shift gears and focus on winning customers back. It's obvious that top line revenue has decreased. They will win some new customers with the additional design galleries that they built in 2017. But you see that they opened four new galleries during 2016, and yet it didn't make a dent in their massive top line revenue losses that we've already discussed. It's nearly a double digit top line revenue loss versus the previous year, and their net income also took a hit. So still some warning signs when it comes to Restoration Hardware. You like the fact that they are trying new things. The members program at Restoration Hardware has been incredibly successful. They've gotten a lot of people signed up. And now that they're doing membership renewals, because it is a $100 one-time annual fee, they'll get some of that cash infusion in the first portion of 2017, in calendar year 2017, and this may help out in the long term as well.
Yeah, and they had mentioned that, talking about the share buybacks, and that not only are the membership renewals are going to help them out from a cash position, but also the new locations that they plan on opening. And as of November, they had 85 total retail galleries, but this is up from about 64 they had this time last year. So they're going to hopefully be operating at a high level from their retail locations, really putting through those orders, and to hopefully get into where they have a lot of cash on hand to purchase those shares. Again, no time frame with that, but it will help out their earnings per share metric, even if they buy back only $100 million of the proposed $300 million in shares outstanding. But overall, a very odd time for Restoration Hardware is, again, they are going through a massive transition. You're seeing that the six new design galleries that they're opening in 2017, five of those six will actually have either cafes, wine vaults, or coffee bars. And then if you see their total store portfolio, you see that each one basically has a different concept. They have about a dozen different concepts. They're not all structured. I equate Restoration Hardware with something like a tile shop, even though they sell entirely different things. You can see that Tile Shop has a very solid structure about them. Anytime they open a new location, it's pretty much going to be the same as the next. Not the case with Restoration Hardware, and that is an interesting concept, but it again speaks to their brand and how they want to differentiate from the merchandising standpoint. Something you can definitely see if you go on their website. They are all about their product offerings, and even through the investor relations page, they're showcasing their new items.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the point in Retail Focus where we each tell you about one story that we're looking ahead to over the next week or month. And Leighton, we'll begin with you.
Yeah, so I'm keeping along the same track of the earnings news that we've been talking about, this time with Foot Locker. And this is a retailer we've talked about several times, is really beating down their competition. Competition most notably in the U.S. is Finish Line. Foot Locker came in with fourth quarter earnings ended January 28th. The specialty athletic footwear retailer came in with $189 million in profit, or $1.42 per share. This more than beat expectations. Estimates were between $1.31 per share and $1.35 per share. So they beat on the profit front, but also Foot Locker beat on the revenue front. They hit $2.11 billion for the period, and this also beat analyst expectations of around $2 billion for the quarter. So just operating in an extremely high level, and you have to wonder, as you're looking through this report, what made them so successful when Finish Line's been having a lot of problems, particularly with women's wear and really streamlining their athletic wear, their product selection. And this is an interesting time for Foot Locker because, as we've mentioned even throughout this podcast, people talk about depreciating mall traffic and those types of things, but Foot Locker has been killing it quarter after quarter, and this is a very good piece of news for that retailer.
Well, I'm looking at another financial release as well this next week. In fact, Thursday of this next week, March 2nd, Costco will release their second quarter earnings results and sales results. And again, as I mentioned before in the podcast, Costco does update everyone on same-store sales on a monthly basis. So we know what to expect as far as same-store sales is concerned, which is about a 2 to 3% increase. Their December sales results saw a 3% increase in same-store sales. But what I'm more anxious to see is how much they reference their credit card shift during this earnings call, which will be taking place at 2 p.m. Pacific time on March 2nd. Motley Fool, the always excellent Motley Fool, had an article looking at the Costco replacement of American Express as their loan accepted credit card with Visa. And this was something that, man, they took a big hit for on the press front last year, last spring, as they were executing this switch. People were complaining about certain cards not working. People were complaining about their American Express cards not being automatically switched over to Visa. However, just based on same store sales increases, it looks as though the credit card may have at least partially helped develop their top line revenue. Now, whether the company credits the credit card switch or not in the earnings release, that's really what I'm looking at. I want to see how much they reference the increase in traffic that they're seeing through the lens of switching credit card providers. I think, honestly, switching to Visa seemed like a great idea, great plan for Costco to win over more generalized consumers. And I also want to see how they've been growing in e-commerce, because even though their e-commerce is a very good deal if you are a non-member, you only have to pay a $1 non-member fee to shop at their e-commerce website, it is still a little bit stodgy, and I think it would be fair to say that their website isn't fully up to date. So I want to see how they address e-commerce earnings next Thursday as well. That'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Make sure you check out Food Focus, which will be dropping in a few days. If you haven't subscribed to that podcast, please do. I encourage you, if you enjoy the Retail Focus, you will enjoy Food Focus. Next week, we'll be talking about solid earnings from Sprouts, as well as a shortcoming at Papa John's. So you'll want to make sure and download that episode. As always, follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast, and we're always available via email, retailpodcast@gmail.com. Don't hesitate to reach out, or if you've got a story that you'd like us to cover, more than happy to accommodate that as well. Again, we will see you 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.